I'm Ron Esposito. In a few moments, we'll be talking with filmmaker John Anderson about his documentary on the great blues harmonica player, Paul Butterfield. The film is entitled Horn from the Heart, the Paul Butterfield story, and it will be shown at the Woodward Theater on Main Street and over the Rhine on Wednesday, November 7, starting at 7 p.m. And also, harmonica player Johnny Walker and his group will be performing as well. And on the phone with me now is the film's director, John Anderson. It's a pleasure to have you on Local Exposure here on WVXU. Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thanks for your interest in our film.
Yeah, we can't wait to see this film. I tell you, John, for those of us who love the blues and for those of us who got into the blues in the 1960s, particularly mid-late 1960s, Paul Butterfield is an awfully large figure. How did your interest in Paul come about?
Well, you're right. He's a complex figure, both in a musical sense and as a person. You know, they say he wasn't easy to get to know. But to really answer your question, the origins of this film go back to the mid-60s when the producer, Sandra Warren, was a fan of Butter's at the Café Agogo in New York. She was young. He stuck in her craw, and she remembered it. And after her law career, she set in motion to spread the gospel of Paul, and eventually was led to me to make this film with her via Corky Siegel. So that's the technical side. I first saw him on August 2nd, 1969. I remember the day. It was the Saturday of the Atlantic City Pop Festival, a big outdoor festival at the Atlantic City racetrack a couple of weeks before Woodstock. And it was all most of the same bands that played at Woodstock. And then Paul came out middle of the afternoon and just blew our brains out. We had never heard anything that intense. And it stuck with me. And I feel really lucky to have been a part of the film.
Yeah, and I tell you, man, I love that quote from Butterfield in reference to the harmonica. He says, "It's such a personal instrument, really like a horn from the heart."
Yeah, think about it. Is there any more direct way to communicate? I mean, you've got fingers on strings with guitars. This is just your air, or, you know, it's your oxygen. And of course, the reeds are involved, but you know, I kind of get what he's saying, don't you?
Absolutely, brother. In fact, we all know the core of any great blues performance, composition, it's all about coming from the heart. That's what communicates, huh?
And who did it with more power and more finesse, or I guess I would say range, than Butter? You know, he could go from the quietest ballad, and in fact, Tolan Bells on Is that on the first or the second record? I can't ever remember, but that was a live favorite, and he would often try to end shows with that, and it would be one of those things where the band quiets down, and he, with his harmonica, walks away from the microphone, and the whole thing just quiets down to nothing. From that to the horn section with Sanborn and Madeo and Dinwiddie and Trevor Lawrence, I mean, as Sanborn said, it was a hurricane up there. He'd never felt a force like that.
Yeah, I mean, as a musician that was involved with playing the blues for about 15 years here in the Cincinnati area, I can relate to that emotion and feeling while you're in the midst of the music. And Butterfield definitely had a great band behind him, particularly on the early records.
Oh, he always did, you know. You start with the very first record and start with the band that he put together for his very first gig at Big John's in Chicago. He already knew Elvin, so Elvin was the guitarist. He needed a rhythm section, and it happened that Wolf's band was out of work because Wolf was doing his folk blues thing in Europe without them and kept extending the tour, and they needed to feed their families. So Paul said, "Hey, come work for me," and they did. And, you know, they, along with every other person that we spoke with that was in his band, and we must have spoken to 20 or 30 of them, they all said the same thing. Paul never told them what to play. He hired them because he liked them, and he let them create their parts. And, you know, that's part of the magic of keeping a band happy is giving them their own heads. And he really did that.
Yeah, you're right about that. All the great band leaders, blues or jazz, seemed to hire guys that they liked the way they played and let them do it, huh?
Yeah, and then when Billy Davenport took over for Sam Lay, Sam had a very classic blues style. Billy was more jazzy, and that certainly helped set the tone for East West, which was his first record. And you can't say that that didn't influence the way that Bloomfield played and the Eastern modalities they got into and the unusual time signatures. I mean, it all just kind of grew out of the personalities of the band members, but always spearheaded by Paul's just toughness and strength.
Yeah, man, I tell you what, that East West recording, as far as, extended improvisation, modal playing, I tell you what, I used to love to put that record on and just take a little trip with the music.
You weren't alone. And then, you might have thought that Paul would have stuck with that. It was getting to be commercially successful, but no. After the hard-driving, rock-edged Chicago authenticity of the first record, he didn't stick with that either. He goes into East West, which is another world. And then the very next thing he does is, I guess it's the Big Boy Crabshaw album, and it's horns. Suddenly there's horns in his blues band. That's what the film is about, is his evolution as a musician and his what he was like as a person. And as you know, a big part of Paul was standing up for social justice. And, his bands, he was always colorblind, and so was everybody in his band.
Yeah, which was for that period of time, I mean, things were starting to obviously break open socially, and for a white guy to be using the heavy black players that he was using, it says something about how black players respected Paul. Paul obviously revered black musicians. Of course, they were his influences. And of course, being in Chicago, this is black music.
It is. And Paul came from a unique vantage point, and as much as he was from the south side of Chicago, it was Hyde Park, which was one of the few somewhat racially integrated, happily communities in the country at that point. So he saw quality close up. So it was no surprise, really, that when Billy Davenport first joined the band, he told Billy, hey, who was an African American, he said, Billy, where you can't go, we won't go. And he lived by that, and he fought for it, and it really gave him high esteem amongst his peers.
The sounds of those Butterfield records are like echoing in my head now, John, as we're speaking. I'm thinking of Mary, Mary, and Born in Chicago. Wow.
Well, both those songs are in the film. Mary Mary is, I think, the only one used in its entirety because it's used for the credits, so all 255 of it get to be there. And then Born in Chicago, what a nice situation where the song, your big hit, is written by your partner in crime and your best friend. He and Nick were the, most say, were the models for the Blues Brothers. And those guys hung, and Nick took Paul to his first blues place, introduced him to Muddy. They would go to all the clubs on the West and the South Side, which weren't all that peaceful, and it was late at night, and it was dangerous. Nick carried a gun. He just comes from that unbelievably authentic milieu, and it shows in his music.
Yeah, I would agree. And Nick Gravanides was a good cat to be associated with there. I'm again, as we're talking, I'm fondly remembering my visits to the west side of Chicago, to the original Checkerboard Lounge. God, I loved that place.
Yeah, and think of the stories those walls could tell. I was there once, shortly before it closed. I was there to see the Black Lone Ranger, and he was a guy who wore a mask like the Lone Ranger. And
Yeah.
it was about 2 hours past the start time, and I went up to the club owner, and there were just a few people there. And I said, when's the Lone Ranger going to play? And he said, next time he wins a hand. And he opens up the door into this card game that's going on, and everybody else has a pile of money except him, so that's what we were waiting for. But the checkerboard was like, it was real life. All of the characters that made up that world and the world of this film, which are really just half a generation younger than the Black Lone Ranger, of course, I'm talking about the Bonnie Raitts and David Sanborn and Elvin and Jack Holzman, who's in the film, and B.B. King, who's about Lone Ranger's age, Maria Muldaur, Marshall Chess. They all lived on this stuff, and they feel that they owe so much to people like the Black Lone Ranger. And Paul was no different. Of course, that was why Gravanitis and he and Bloomfield organized the Fathers and Sons show, so that they could show the guys who taught them, Muddy especially, what they learned from them and give them their thanks. It was a beautiful gesture.
Yes, it was. And of course, Paul readily admitting that, you know, Muddy Waters, Little Walter, and Howlin' Wolf, and all those guys who came up from the South were his guys. They were his people.
Yeah, and, you know, it kept reflecting. Of course, the look in Muddy's eyes when he sees Paul on stage with him at the last waltz is priceless. And it was really just about a year before that that Muddy, partly out of respect to Paul, came up to Woodstock to record his Woodstock album. And then, of course, Paul paved the way for Muddy. Paul, when he went to San Francisco and got Bill Graham's ear, he and Bloomers said, hey, you really ought to bring the Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, and I guess Little Walter was gone, but B.B. King especially, you got to bring them to your rock palaces. And Bill did, and made a big difference to those guys economically. Suddenly they were playing bigger clubs, and, you know, the kids were ready for some authenticity. So it worked out great for them, too.
Also, you know, I got to tip the mic to Jack Holzman, who was running Elektra Records at that time. You know, Elektra was a darn groundbreaking record label at that period of time.
It sure was, and they sure went out on a limb to sign Paul and stay with him. You know, there was nothing else like that in the marketplace, but that was the beauty and the genius of Jack Holzman. He knew music, and he trusted Paul Rothschild, and he trusted Fritz Richmond's opinion about how that Rothschild ought to come out and see Paul. So it was just based on trust and good ears.
Well, John, thanks so much for talking with us today. I can't wait to see the film Horn from the Heart, the Paul Butterfield story. Thanks so much for your work, John. We really appreciate it.
Well, I thank you, and I urge your listeners to go to our website, which is hornfromtheheart.com. And I also want to put a shout-out to Sandy Warren, my co-filmmaker on this. She's the executive producer and co-writer. Without her, this film never would have been made.
All right. So from my heart to yours, thanks a million, John. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been in conversation with filmmaker John Anderson, talking about his latest film, Horn from the Heart, the Paul Butterfield story. And the film will be shown at the Woodward Theater on Main Street and over the Rhine on Wednesday evening, November 7 at 7 p.m. Also on the bill, harmonica player Johnny Walker and his group. The Cincinnati Blues Society sponsoring this show. And more information can be found on our website, wvxu.org/LX. For local exposure, I'm Ron Esposito.